Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, how the war in Ukraine has changed the world nuclear reality. When the Soviet Union fell, many historians believed the nuclear threat was largely behind us. Russian President Mikhail Gorbachev said at the time, the danger of nuclear war had, quote, practically disappeared. But my guest today says Russia's invasion of Ukraine has changed all that. Robin Wright is a contributing writer and columnist at The New Yorker and a distinguished fellow at both the Woodrow Wilson Center and the U.S. Institute of Peace. She argues that the international community has neglected the infrastructure of global security for years. And as Russia continues to dangle the prospect of deploying a nuclear weapon, the entire notion of deterrence has been put at risk. Robin Wright, let's start with Russia itself and what it is saying about the potential for the use of nuclear weapons. How seriously should we take that threat?
Vladimir Putin has put his nuclear forces on the highest alert. He's also made some rather brazen statements implying that in some circumstances, Russia might use its nuclear arsenal. Russia's nuclear doctrine actually is that it will use nuclear weapons only in a conflict involving nuclear arms, except if the state or its leadership feels threatened. Its existence, their existence, feel threatened by a non-nuclear event. So the door is open to him if he should want to use a nuclear weapon in the war in Ukraine.
So what does that really mean? Can anyone truly understand what is in Putin's head as he makes those statements? Is he making them simply to threaten the world when he knows that should he use nuclear weapons would also be used against him?
Well, that's not necessarily true. But I'm not in Putin's head, fortunately. But we have assessments from two of the highest intelligence people in America, and their words kind of explain where we are. William Burns, who is a former ambassador to Russia, is now the CIA director, said in testimony before Congress, given the potential desperation of Vladimir Putin and the Russian leadership, given the setbacks that they've faced so far militarily, none of us should take lightly the threat posed by a potential resort to a tactical nuclear weapon or a low-yield nuclear weapon. We'll talk in a minute about what those weapons are. And the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, which is another of the 16 wings of intelligence operations in the United States, also spoke to Congress about the threat this month. And Lieutenant General Scott Barrier said that a prolonged war in Ukraine could zap Russia's manpower and materiel, while sanctions could throw the nation into an economic depression and undermine its ability to produce the kind of precision-guided munitions, you know, the conventional arms, the big stuff. So he said, and this is a quote, as this war and its consequences slowly weaken Russia's conventional strength, Russia likely will increasingly rely on its nuclear deterrent to signal the West and project strength to its internal and external audiences. I think the fear in the United States is that Russia becomes more militaristic. I think so far what we've seen is saber rattling, Putin is trying to strut. He's trying to threaten, that he's willing, you know, to threaten the West, the outside world, with the first use of nuclear weapons in 77 years. It's very interesting that the Biden administration has not taken the bait and has tried to avoid getting into a rhetorical cycle that would escalate and possibly, you know, trigger something more. So for now, we're still in the rhetorical stage, but it is what's happened in the evolution of nuclear weapons since World War II, since we went through the horrific bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that has changed the debate about what nuclear war might look like.
Tell me first, explain tactical nuclear weapons.
Well, let me put it the other way around. Strategic nuclear weapons are what we're all kind of educated on, that going back to nuclear strikes on Hiroshima and Nagasaki that wipe out a city and destroy human beings within range. You know, these horrific, long-range, big-yield strategic weapons. But what's happened since the end of World War II is that countries have also developed smaller yield, smaller range nukes, which are called tactical nuclear weapons.
These can have a range of what, 300 miles or so?
Yes. A strategic is 3,000 miles and it has a big yield. A tactical weapon has a range of 300 miles and can have a smaller yield, but it will still have a yield that's in some cases bigger than the bomb in Hiroshima. And they're designed for different things. A tactical nuclear weapon is designed to hit, for example, a tank formation. Remember the famous 40 tanks or 40-mile-long row of tanks going into Ukraine, or a large mass of troops. It's not designed to take out a city, to destroy a city. It's really used as a kind of battlefield weapon rather than against a whole society. And so in that way, it's different. I think Americans have not been conscious of tactical weapons because of their range. There's no country, Canada or Mexico, that has a tactical nuclear weapon. And so that's not a threat for us. And yet in Europe, that's the biggest threat. And in terms of 21st century uses, that's the biggest threat. And you wouldn't necessarily drop it on the ground, on that tank formation, or on that mass of troops. You can also detonate a tactical nuclear weapon in space. So that, for example, and not even over a country, you could do it over the Baltic Sea, for example, a place that would not drop immediately on people, but it would take out the electromagnetic pulse and therefore disable your ability to use modern electronics. Or it could be just used in a way that would signal to the West, the 21st century is the battlefield of nuclear weapons. And be careful because Russia's willing to do more than, you know, than just fight on the ground. And it would be a very ominous signal and a turn in the war.
So since World War II, since the breakup of the Soviet Union, and since Putin came to power, he's been concentrating on building up armaments. While what has the U.S. been doing?
Well, it was very interesting. In the aftermath of World War II, the United States focused on its new nuclear weapon and building up its arsenal because Russia, the Soviet Union at the time, had such a mass of forces in Europe and had a much larger conventional presence. And the U.S. calculation was that if the Soviet Union opted to use its conventional army, its troops in Europe again, that the U.S. could use its nuclear weapons. Well, what happened after the end of the Cold War in 1991 was you saw the proliferation of arms control treaties that both sides agreed to draw down their strategic nuclear weapons. And they did. They got them down significantly. But the Russians have more than we do now, 6,000 strategic weapons, and we have about 5,500. But the more interesting thing is that there has never been a treaty or an agreement of any sort about tactical nuclear weapons, which is something most people don't understand. Never in the history of arms. And so what either country does is what they want to. And at one point, the Soviet Union had 25,000 tactical nuclear weapons. Wow. Well, both sides began to reduce them after the Cold War, because these are things that don't have a terribly long shelf life. They have to be maintained and so forth. But Russia today has 2,000 tactical nuclear warheads, and the United States only has 200. So what's happened is that whole process and the arms and the kind of arms focus and strength has inverted since the end of World War II. We used to have a nuclear force, and the Russians were mightier on conventional weaponry. Now we're stronger on conventional weaponry after two decades of fighting wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Our focus has been on, you know, insurgencies on the ground, whereas the Russians have a really big nuclear arsenal.
So tell me about the test that Russia carried out on April the 20th. And why this matters so much.
Well, one of the things that's always interesting is what kind of delivery systems do countries have for their nuclear arms? And the Russians have many means of carrying tactical nuclear weapons, from torpedoes, from missiles launched by land or sea, from submarines. Well, as the United States only has one, we drop them from airplanes. They're gravity bombs, as they call them, capable of carrying a nuclear warhead. What's interesting is that Russia has tested successfully a missile capable of flying at hypersonic speed and also capable of carrying 10 nuclear warheads. Now, the test was successful. That doesn't mean that it can deploy it tomorrow. It still has to make them and deploy them. But it has contributed to the kind of ominous optics of the moment. And you combine that with, you know, where Russia has done or what it hasn't done in Ukraine war, what its ambitions are, what its arsenal is, and what its delivery systems are. You know, it's a moment that people should educate themselves once again. It's not to, you know, I don't want to ring any alarm bells either, but I think it's something that the word nuclear has to come back into the public lexicon again.
I don't understand how it is that the United States, seeing what was happening in Russia and the development of these various launching pads that Russia was creating, where was the U.S. in its thinking as it saw Russia doing these things?
Well, I'm not at the Pentagon. I do think the Pentagon does game an awful lot of possible scenarios. But remember, for 20 years, we fought a war in Afghanistan in response to the 9/11 attacks that ended, you know, abruptly and tragically last year. And we also opted to invade Iraq, where we still have troops. And I think the focus has been on counterterrorism. While the Soviet Union, which had defined, you know, 40 years of a Cold War, had fallen a little bit lower. The Biden administration, for example, was focused very heavily on China. The Trump administration, remember, wanted to disband NATO and get out of Europe. Thank God we didn't. You know, that would have really given an open invitation to Vladimir Putin to take back not just Ukraine, but some of the other territories that were once part of the Soviet Union. You know, again, authoritarian regimes and dictators don't have the timelines and accountability factors that democracies do. And resources are always limited. So, but mercifully, at least we did recognize the, as Russia was mounting its troops along the border, we did realize what was beginning to happen. I think one of the ironies is we didn't want to do more to help Ukraine earlier on because we thought Russia is a nuclear state because of the nuclear reality. And we wanted to prevent doing anything to provoke him in a way that would lead him to use a nuclear weapon. So if we were playing chess, you could say, you know, Putin is playing white and he's on the aggressive, and the West is playing black and on the defensive.
So Putin, because of what's happening in Ukraine, that perhaps does not look great for Russia itself, is thinking more in nuclear terms because he and Russia will not be defeated?
I think, Diane, this first phase, the first and second now phase of the war have shifted. I think he ambitiously thought, and his military convinced him, that they could sweep into Kyiv within 72 hours. And that was actually some of the thinking in Washington as well, that this was going to, he was going to divide the country and then try to move after taking the capital, ousting the government, and then try eventually to absorb the rest of the state. But what no one counted on was the ferocity, dedication, motivation of the Ukrainian troops and how fantastically they have fought an army that is, I think, almost 8 to 10 times larger than it is and certainly better equipped. And they have, and they've pushed them back. I think in this phase too, the Russians themselves have said that their goal is getting Eastern Donbass, this area which is predominantly Russian speakers, and to connect a landmass in the south with Crimea, which the Russians seized in 2014. That's kind of phase two. Now, I suspect that will not end then. You know, Putin, there's a lot at stake for Putin. He's, you know, looking at his legacy, and he doesn't have an ideology. It's all geography and, you know, what is Russia? What is Russia's natural possessions? And he believes that Ukraine is part of that. So I think he does want Ukraine. I think he wants probably more than that. He's his people in the last week have talked about Moldova, which would be, you know, moving into that small country south of Ukraine, or kind of surrounded by Ukraine in the south. And, you know, beyond, Putin has never been happy about the push of NATO into countries that used to be allied with the Soviet Union. He doesn't like that sense of vulnerability. So I think during the second phase, it's unlikely that he would resort to a nuke. But this use of language is one that is a terror tactic. It's saber rattling. It's trying to say, well, we can always use it. It's a little bit like crying wolf. And at some point, you know, either people will understand that it's calling wolf and he doesn't intend to cross the barrier of using nuclear weapons for the second time on Earth. Or he may, if the Russians don't succeed, if Ukrainians push them back ever further, there is that danger that he tries something different that would really shock the world. And that's using a tactical nuclear weapon.
Wow.
I have to say, this all started when I went to do an exit interview with General McKenzie, who is the head of Central Command. And I expected to talk about, you know, ISIS and Afghanistan and Iran and the kind of the things under his command. And I began by saying, you became a young Marine in 1979. How has the nature of warfare changed since then? And he said, we're back to where we were.
Wow.
And so I had two long sessions with him, separate places. And we spent 2/3 of the time talking about nuclear weapons.
Now, a quick break. When we return, the rest of my conversation with Robin Wright.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Robin Wright, writer and columnist at The New Yorker. Robin Wright, yesterday, the Secretary of Defense announced that we'd be sending more conventional weapons to Ukraine. How effective will those conventional weapons be against Russian forces who seem to be laying flat portions of cities, towns, raping women, killing children, even when they know children are there? How effective will those weapons be in holding off the Russians, and for how long?
Well, one of the things that's interesting is about the type of weapons we're sending in. Originally, we were sending in weapons for defensive use, and now we're sending weapons for more offensive use. One of the things to remember, too, we're sending them for use in a conflict that is very close to the Russian border. And every time there is fighting that is closer to the Russian border, there is the danger that the U.S. weapons, as the Russians have already implied, mean that the United States is involved in the war. You know, this is where, in reality, Ukraine has already become America's war. When you look at the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, mobilizing 40-plus countries in Ramstein this week, countries that extend well beyond NATO, to help Ukraine, we're the ones out there now creating a coalition of what they call nations of goodwill to support Ukraine, arm it, train its forces, do everything but fight itself. The U.S. is providing intelligence. We're advising the Ukrainians. And the deeper that connection becomes, the more the kind of West, the outside world, the Russians are going to probably interpret this as not just a war over Ukrainian territory, but a war that is a bit like, you know, I almost hate to say this, that looks a little bit like the run-up to World War II, you know, when at first the United States didn't want to get involved directly. It supported its allies, but wasn't going to go there, and then eventually got sucked in because it came under attack. And all it's going to take is some kind of stray Russian plane that flies into Poland by accident, even over airspace, and gets shot down, or the Russians going for those convoys that are bringing in weaponry from Poland into Ukraine, they get zapped. You know, that there are a lot of things that can still happen that will trigger tripwires. And this is a very delicate balancing act. How do you make sure this is the fighting is just Ukraine against Russia and doesn't cross that threshold? Because then, you know, all bets are off.
So despite the efforts of the Secretary of Defense in bringing together all these countries and urging them to help in the safety of Ukraine, you wrote that the infrastructure of global security is decaying. You compared it to old bridges and railways. What do you mean?
Well, I think Americans understand that our infrastructure is fraying, and, you know, our roads, our communications, systems, our electric grids, bridges, and so forth are fraying, that they need to be rebuilt or repaired. We need to pay attention to them. And the same thing has happened in arms control, that we're seeing the erosion of the global security architecture. And the treaties, the enforcement mechanisms, the rules, they're not physical, but they're just as important when it comes to our physical security, that the treaties that were signed and negotiated since the 1970s, all but one have either been abandoned or expired or been, you know, or afraid to the point that they're non-existent. Trump walked away from the Open Skies Treaty, which gave us means of kind of verifying, you know, if we could fly over and check what facilities, what silos, et cetera, each country had. There's only one left, and that's the New START Treaty on nuclear weapons. And that was set to expire last year. And in his first acts, Biden and Putin agreed to extend it for 5 years. So there's no guarantee it will survive either. And one of the men closest to Putin, Medvedev, recently said this year after the war broke out that Russia didn't see much need of it given what was happening on the ground. So there's this danger that the kind of bilateral relationship we've had, that the mechanisms we've had for discussion, for dialogue, for checking on each other, has almost been abandoned. I mean, all the big stuff that went into the talks by Republican and Democratic presidents, this was something that was bipartisan and endorsed and ratified, all of these treaties. And then when you take a look at the wider world, if you have the fraying of agreements between Russia and the United States, then you have a problem about the one longest agreement dating back to the 1960s called the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which covers the whole world because there are today 9 nuclear powers.
Exactly.
And, you know, United States, Russia, China, France, Britain, North Korea, Israel, Pakistan, and India. And the Non-Proliferation Treaty, known as the NPT, specifies that the goal is to disarm all nuclear weapons among those that have them and prevent other countries from getting them. And so if you see the fraying of the U.S.-Russia treaties or the abandonment, that undermines the cornerstone, the rock on which arms control and global safety, the basis of human survival and warfare, has been based. And that's what's scary. So there's an awful lot at stake at this, on this issue. And I'm grateful that you're willing to talk about it.
And what about Iran? What negotiations, while they're stalled, may continue in the face of this saber rattling from Russia, the invasion into parts of Ukraine? What is Iran thinking, doing? You've been so articulate about Iran and written books about Iran. Tell me about their own thinking regarding nuclear weapons.
So the 2015 nuclear deal was the most significant non-proliferation agreement on nuclear weapons in more than a quarter century. And it was important not just to prevent Iran from getting a bomb, but also as a signal to other countries aspiring to get a bomb. Don't do it. And if Iran had been allowed to get a bomb, then you could also see other countries like Saudi Arabia, others in the Middle East, trying to get a weapon. And there would have been a new arms race. So it's much bigger than Iran itself. So one of the great tragedies with this arms control agreement was that President Trump arbitrarily walked away from it, even though It was agreement negotiated by the world's six major powers and Iran. We were just one equal signatory to it. And that has undermined the agreement. And the Iranians for a year still stuck to it, kept its limits. But as Trump also reimposed sanctions, the Iranians started breaching their obligations under the accord steadily to try to pressure the Trump administration, kind of a game of brinksmanship. And President Biden had campaigned on an agreement to go back to the nuclear deal. And talks started again in March last year in Vienna. And they got all the issues settled but one. And that is, would Iran's Revolutionary Guards be taken off the U.S. terrorism list? It is the first military that the U.S. has ever slapped on the label that it is a terrorist group. The U.S. never did it to the Nazis, never did it to the Soviet Army, but we did it to the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards. And kind of as a point of pride, it's unrelated to the nuclear deal, but the because President Trump listed them after the nuclear deal was agreed, after we walked away from it, it's kind of a side issue. And the U.S. argues that it's a side issue and shouldn't be part of the negotiations. And it's also actually irrelevant because even if the Biden administration decided to delist it, to remove that label, all the sanctions that have been imposed on the IRGC would still be in place for many reasons. Their support of a nuclear program, for their development of ballistic missiles, for their human rights abuses, for their meddling intervention in the neighboring countries. So it wouldn't change any of the realities. It would literally take them off a list, which sounds like a big deal, but in practice, it actually isn't. And so the U.S. has said, look, that's not part of the deal. That's a separate issue, and it wouldn't change very much. And the Iranians are saying there's no good faith. We want to go back to the way it was at the time of the nuclear deal when the IRGC was not listed. So at this point, we are at a very, very, very serious and dangerous stage where what was on all the achievements of the Iran nuclear deal, getting Iran's program so that they had to dismantle parts, dismantle facilities, give up stockpiles. It would take a year for them to get back to where they were in developing enough fuel, enriched uranium, for a bomb. That, so it wouldn't be a danger and it would allow the world a year to develop military plans. The problem is, Iran is now probably 2 to 3 weeks within having enough enriched uranium. And this process has stalled. And there's still a possibility, but it's a very slim possibility, that there will be an agreement.
You mentioned sanctions in regard to Iran. How effective do you believe the sanctions against Russia have been in trying to halt the destruction of Ukraine?
I've covered sanctions all over the world, in Africa against Rhodesia and South Africa when I lived there, covering wars and the anti-apartheid movement in the 70s. I've covered them in Venezuela. I've been to North Korea and Cuba, seeing how sanctions are playing out. I've seen them in Iraq, Iran. And there are only two major tools for countering aggression. And one is war, and the other is sanctions. War is fast, sanctions are slow, just the rule of thumb. In Cuba, six decades later, you still have a communist regime in power. In North Korea, we've gone through three generations of the Kim family, and North Korea has more nuclear weapons, more ballistic missiles than ever, despite incredibly punitive sanctions and international isolation. Iran, since Trump reimposed sanctions, actually has claims to be almost selling as much oil as it did when sanctions were lifted as part of the nuclear deal between 2015 and 2016. So sanctions, you know, the idea that this is going to cripple Russia fast enough is an illusion. It's a long-term weapon. And Russia, being a major economy, will be hurt. The Treasury projects that it will lose 15% of its GDP this year. It's going to have a hard time, perhaps most importantly, buying the parts it needs to build new tanks and munitions. That's really a key. It has lost, according to the Pentagon, 25% of its combat power in just 2 months. So it will be scrambling. But is it the kind of thing that is going to get Vladimir Putin to back down? I don't think so anytime soon if we base it on sanctions elsewhere in the world over many, many decades.
So how do you see this coming to an end?
Well, I don't see it coming to an end anytime soon. There's one possibility that Putin may take the Donbas, get its land connection to Crimea, take a step back and rebuild. Remember, poor Ukraine has been at war since 2014 when Crimea was annexed abruptly by Putin, and the little green men, as they call them, the Russian-backed separatists in Donbas in the east, began fighting for independence or autonomy. And you know, we may then see a break, stalemate, you know, attempts at peace. I think the Ukrainians are not willing anymore to do some kind of compromise that says they'll return to neutrality and cede something on Crimea. I just don't think after their losses, the war crimes, and as some people allege, the genocide that has gone on, that Zelensky is in a position to compromise. So I'm not sure that negotiations would go very far. And I think we're more likely to see Russia come back. I think Putin has stepped in to quicksand, and there's no way to get out. And it's just the pace at which the war plays out and in phases. There are lots of unintended consequences in these situations as they drag on, and what spark triggers something bigger or different. And I think everyone should be concerned about that. You can only hope that it will stop at some point, but that still would mean that Ukraine does not have all of Ukraine back. And I think that that Zelensky does not want to go back to the situation that Ukraine faced on February 23rd, the day before, when they'd lost Ukraine and two areas of eastern Donbass had declared their independence and had been recognized as independent states by Russia. You know, this is a very complicated war, but it's one that, frankly, will determine the future of the West, the future of kind of the balance of power on Earth. It will have major consequences for kind of the principle of aggression. Does Xi Jinping in China look at Taiwan and think, well, Putin got away with it and the world messed around but couldn't stop? There's a lot of stuff happening in the background that, you know, we are not great at multitasking conflicts, and it's clear that leaders are taking advantage of the focus of our attention being so heavily on Ukraine. The stakes are huge, though, for Ukraine. I don't think there's been a more important war in terminating and having global repercussions since World War II. And this is one that we have to pay attention to. And I think the Biden administration has tried very hard to provide weaponry, tried to achieve that balance that it doesn't look like America's war when the reality is that we're all in, except for manpower. We're doing everything else that we can to help.
Do you see manpower, U.S. manpower, going in?
Not in the foreseeable future. I think the Ukrainians have proven to be unbelievably motivated and effective fighters. And the question is, at what point, as the war is intensifies on the eastern border, are there more attacks inside Ukraine? And Russia feels that the war is bigger. This is where it's really hard to game wars. And Russia is an unpredictable player right now. So I wish we all knew, we saw what a viable end game is. There are some options, possibilities. But I think Putin is so angry and so much at stake in terms of his personal legacy and his illusions of being Peter the Great and recreating not the Soviet Union, but the Russian Empire. Remember, Putin doesn't have an ideology. And the Ukrainians now having given up so much, having seen so much of the country destroyed, don't want to live with a smaller landlocked version of itself.
Robin Wright, thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
That was Robin Wright. She's a writer and columnist at The New Yorker and a distinguished fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center and the U.S. Institute of Peace. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Please be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.